from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, it's been a busy month in the field of artificial intelligence. In a face-off of man versus machine, the world champion of the Go board game lost to Google's AI program. And just last week, Microsoft unveiled a program designed to tweet like a teenage girl, only to have it wind up praising Hitler and blasting feminists. Both these events offer a glimpse into the machine learning industry, where companies are competing to create the first viable artificial intelligence software. We'll discuss the latest in AI and machine learning, a field that's estimated to reach $40 billion by 2020. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The next stage of the information age, we're told, will be machine learning and artificial intelligence. And AI is already pervasive in our daily routines, personalizing our online shopping, making our cars smarter, and organizing our photos. But these applications are just the beginning, and the race is on among companies like Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, who are engaging in a platform war to dominate AI. This opening Forum Hour, we focus on artificial intelligence, big data, machine learning, and technological changes that will remake our world, and the competition that is certainly sorting out things as we are speaking here. Let me tell you who we're going to be speaking with in the course of this hour. Cade Metz is with us in studio. He's senior writer for Wired. His reporting on Microsoft and AI can be found online at wired.com. And Cade Metz, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Also good to have Pedro Domingos, who joins us by phone this morning from Seattle. He's professor of computer science and engineering at University of Washington. He's also the author of The Master Algorithm, How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. Pedro Domingos, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Andrew Ng, who joins us this morning from Silicon Valley. He's now chief scientist with Baidu, a Chinese web services company that's based in Beijing, which has often been called the Google of China. He leads Baidu Research, which has artificial intelligence labs in Silicon Valley and Beijing, and he's also co-founder and chair of Coursera, which is the online course company where he taught a popular course on machine learning, and he's associate professor of computer science at Stanford. And welcome, Andrew Ng.
Thanks, Michael.
Glad to have you with us and glad to have you all aboard. Cade Metz, let me begin with you. We're talking about machine learning and AI, and there's certainly a boom. In fact, at this point, one has to realize the fact that in the last couple of years, that boom has taken on, if anything, an even greater force behind it. People, when they think about AI, they think of robots and unicorns sprouting all over and everything. Let's get kind of just a working definition of what we mean by artificial intelligence as opposed to machine learning.
Well, artificial intelligence is a very general term, and it's a very old term, has been used since the late 1950s, and it has been applied to so many things. I think it is right to make a distinction between artificial intelligence and machine learning, which is coming to the fore at the moment. Machine learning, just broadly speaking, is the ability for a machine to learn a task on its own. We've seen this in smaller ways over the past 10, 15 years. A good example is if you use Amazon's website, you'll notice at the bottom of the page there are product recommendations for you. And that is a simple example of machine learning where it learns to analyze the purchases you make on its site and make recommendations based on that. But this type of technology has progressed significantly further in recent years, although not quite as far as some people would expect or would like. But machine learning, for example, it is now able to recognize faces in the photos you post to Facebook or recognize the commands you speak into your cell phone. That's machine learning as well.
And the 80s was spreadsheets, and now we've got machine learning, or I suppose one could say that we had domination certainly to a great extent by Google because of search, and now we have things even moving much more forward in terms of who's going to be dominating in this area.
And these things overlap. Machine learning now helps drive the Google search engine in a very big way. The same type of technology that's, for instance, doing that face recognition on Facebook is helping to drive the Google search engine. This type of technology is becoming used in so many areas. It really underpins so many of the things that you use on your cell phone or in other places.
Now, Pedro Dominguez, we're not just talking about maps and photos here. We're talking about life sciences, cars, really just about everything, aren't we?
Yes, indeed. In fact, if you look at self-driving cars, what makes them possible is machine learning. Nobody actually programmed that car to drive itself. In fact, we don't know how to program a car to drive itself. It learned by watching people drive. And this is one of the things that makes machine learning powerful, is that it lets computers do things that we don't even know how to teach them. The other thing that it lets computers do is, for example, think of online dating, right? People, associate machine learning with many things, but perhaps not that. What the machine learning does there is it tries to figure out who is compatible with whom and then recommend potential matches. And, potentially a very good matchmaker would know how to do this, but they wouldn't know how to do it, for millions of people at the same time. And so machine learning is actually matching people up. And, these days, a third of marriages start on the internet. So, there are children alive today who wouldn't have been born if not for machine learning.
And this is all using big data, what we call big data, right?
Yes. What makes machine learning powerful is that it leverages data, right? So instead of us programming the computer learns by looking at data. And so as the amount of available data grows exponentially, machine learning becomes correspondingly more powerful just on the back of it, as long as we can make it, scale up to those data sets. So it's a very powerful combination.
And we're talking, Andrew, about just an imitation of the human brain and its neural networks and all this?
So I think over the last few decades, as a new type of algorithm called deep learning on neural networks rose, those of us like to describe it as simulating the human brain because it's such an easy analogy to make. But those of us working on this field have started to shy away from that analogy. I think we are very good at building huge machines that can soak up huge amounts of data, do addition, subtraction, multiplications on them, and figure out, say, how to drive a car, right? And it's almost a little bit like magic. But the way these algorithms work maybe takes loose inspiration from the human brain, but if you look at any of the details, it works completely different than what any biological brain does. And in fact, we don't even, frankly, I think despite all the progress in neuroscience, today we have almost no idea, how on earth the human brain works. So I think that one of the upsides of AI is today it's entering so many industries, right? Better web search, better intelligent chatbots, better spam filters, better detecting people's faces and photos. So many things are working so much better from AI, and it will get much better. But I think the easy analogy to the human brain has also, unfortunately, led to a little bit of hype about, machines becoming as smart as humans or simulating the brain, or maybe someday machines will be even smarter than humans. And I think that hype has been a bit unnecessary.
Well, as long as we're talking about analogies that don't quite hold up, when we talk about self-driving cars, we're talking about something utterly distinct, as I believe you and others have pointed out, from what we think of as ourselves driving cars.
Yeah, so I'm responsible for the self-driving car technology at Baidu, and I think that self-driving cars will come very, very soon, but not in the way that most people think. So I think that, once upon a time, here in the United States, we had to adopt from transportation by horses to transportation by trains. And one of the things that made that possible was no one ever tried to treat the train the same way as a horse, right? You might have said, well, horses are really safe. I can stand anywhere and the horse will avoid me. But trains are really stupid. If I stand on the railway track, the train will hit me. So trains have got to be more dangerous than horses. And I think the reality is we learned that it's the nature of a train to run on this railway track. And so we just learned not to stand on the track. And today we have bright flashing signs and so on to warn you when a train is about to approach a railway crossing. I think that today, self-driving cars are a fundamentally different thing than human-driven cars, and we need to learn to treat them differently. One quick example, if you're driving along and you see a construction worker, and the construction worker is, gesturing wildly for you to stop or gesturing wildly for you to go, no self-driving car today can accurately and reliably interpret that construction workers' gestures. And I don't see that problem being solved in the short term. So it seems like self-driving cars are much more stupid compared to human-driven cars. But I think that what we should do is instead give that construction worker a beacon, a wireless beacon, you know, some Wi-Fi thing or some sign that lets them tell the car exactly how they want the car to behave. And with that little change to how construction sites are run, we can solve the problem. And I think if we think about modifying our behaviors around self-driving cars and just treating them differently than human-driven cars, we can make them a reality very soon. And today, 3,000 people a day die from car accidents. And with little changes to the way we run our roads, with help from government, with a private-public partnership to figure this out together, I think we make self-driving cars a reality very soon. We think by 2018, commercial operations by 2018. And I think we'd be well on our way to saving, you know, 3,000 lives a day. And I think that we have almost a more imperative, right, given the number of people that are killed every day, to get there as quickly as possible.
Well, it's often been said that once a self-driving car runs over a child or something along those lines, it may change the whole landscape of it. But it certainly is imminent, and it's down the line for us, as you've pointed out. I'm just wondering, since you founded the Brain Team over at Google, and now you're at Baidu, and there's all kinds of deep learning going on at Baidu. In fact, they had the breakthrough in technology in February at MIT in terms of deep speech, which was named Breakthrough in Technology in the MIT Technology Review. What is it that Baidu is doing, for example, that Google is not doing, or what are they ahead in?
Yeah, it's one of the things that Baidu did well early on was invest in the deep learning platform that we rolled out to the whole company. And by the way, I think Google's a great company. I was very proud when I was leading the Google Brain Team. So really, both are great companies. I think that Baidu has had a huge investment in building supercomputers for deep learning, or we call it high-performance computing, HPC, basically supercomputers. And this is allowing us at Baidu to absorb, you know, huge amounts of data and make our machine learning researchers really productive. Because it turns out that today, deep learning, AI, needs so much data that running these machines takes ages. And Baidu's early lead in investing in, first company to build a large GPU cluster for AI, for deep learning, first company to make a big investment in HPC. I see the rest of the community all around the world following us in these directions, and I hope that this will help other companies also raise the productivity of their machine learning researchers in the same way we've seen here. But today, so many things that Baidu, everything from our core business, from web search and advertising, to speech recognition, which I'm super excited about, to our self-driving car, is powered by deep learning. And maybe in terms of mega trends, it's different between the U.S. and China. In China, we see the rise of China calls it online to offline. The U.S. tends to call it on demand. But because of the high population density of China, as well as the fact that China is a mobile-first society, people use cell phones much more and laptops and desktops less, there is a huge rise of the on-demand economy is growing much faster in China than it is in the U.S. So you can use your cell phone to get your car washed, to get food delivered, to have a chef shop in your house to cook food for you, and it's cheap. You don't even think about it because it's so cheap. So deep learning is one of the major short-term application areas of deep learning, is to power that whole growth of the economy. In addition to, honestly, we do so many things with deep learning, it's hard to enumerate them.
I understand that. And Andrew Ng, again, is with us this morning from down in Sunnyvale. He's chief scientist for Baidu and runs their research. Cade Metz here in studio is science writer with Wired. And we talked about Google. I know you interviewed Diane Greene. You did a whole piece in Wired, in fact, about Google. And they want to essentially, they're sharing their artificial intelligence in their cloud.
It's true. Google, in addition to building many of these technologies for its own use, is now sharing them with the rest of the world via what's called cloud computing. And so you essentially allow other developers and businesses to tap into this same technology and build it into their applications as well. Google sees cloud computing in general as a big part of its future and machine learning as a big part of that, and I think it likely will be. There are other ways they're sharing this technology with the world, But that's one of the primary.
There's a lot at stake here, though, and there's big competition. We're talking about huge competition between Google and Amazon and Microsoft. Yeah.
There is. It's a particularly interesting landscape because these technologies that Andrew is discussing, these so-called deep learning technologies, developed in the academic world. And at this point, there's a relatively small number of people who really know this stuff well and can really advance it to the types of levels that Andrew can. And so these giant companies are very much competing for this relatively small number of researchers. It's a fascinating thing to watch. They pay high salaries for these researchers, and they're all interested in showing in many ways that they are ahead of the competition, and that these very important researchers who work for them. And
it's like getting athletic stars in professional sports, isn't it?
It's a lot like that. It really is.
And Pedro Domingos.
Let me add something to that.
Ahead. Please.
Yeah, Peter Lee, the director of Microsoft Research, who's one of the people trying to hire deep learning researchers, he says that the cost of acquiring a top deep learning expert is comparable to the cost of acquiring a top NFL quarterback prospect.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. As long as we're talking about NFL prospects, there's a lot of competition that I'd like to sort of read your thoughts about, Pedro Domingos, or hear your thoughts about, because I know you've been 20 years in this area of machine learning research. I mean, AI defeats a chess champion, AI wins Jeopardy, AI wins Go. I mean, what do these things tell us, these kinds of competitions?
They tell us that. Right. So AI, they tell us that AI is making a lot of progress, right? So, Go, for example, is a much harder game than chess. It's also very interesting that the way, you look, for example, at chess and Jeopardy and Go, and the ways these were aced were actually all very different. So, Deep Blue actually didn't use any machine learning. It used classic AI search for the best move to make. But Go is too hard for that. There's too many possibilities. So what was amazing about Go was that nobody would have predicted that, at this point in time, computers would actually be able to beat humans. And the way that happened was by a combination of, on the one hand, machine learning. And ironically, however, the way this was done actually goes back to the very beginning of AI and machine learning. And, a guy called Arthur Samuel, who was an IBM researcher, who, as far as I know, coined the term machine learning. He taught a program to play checkers to human level by having the program play against itself and learn from that, which is exactly the same thing, that AlphaGo is doing.
And machine learning is just reshaping everything, isn't it? I mean, it's reshaping our lives and remaking our lives in so many ways. But as long as we're talking about what happened with chess and Jeopardy and Go, I'd like your thoughts about Microsoft, actually, recently. This was a big story. They produced this essentially kind of robot parrot, a young female voice off of Twitter, and it was spouting all kinds of racist things and Hitler and so forth. I mean, it mirrors the users and it mirrors the trolls. Can you explain us what happened here?
Yeah, it was very unfortunate, right? But I think for machine learning researchers, this will not have come as a complete surprise, right? Because what happens is that these programs, they learn by observing what people do and then doing similar things. So they're just acting the way that their users act. So, it started spouting racist things and references to Hitler, partly because, unfortunately, that's what a lot of people do, on Twitter and on the web. But I think it was actually more than that. I think, they for sure, foresaw, they must have done a lot of, stress testing. And they're not saying exactly what happened, what was the vulnerability that was exploited, but there clearly were some hackers or somebody who managed to get the system to start saying these things. My guess is that they exploited what is called in machine learning the cold start problem, which is that in the beginning, a machine learning system is like a newborn baby. It doesn't know anything, right? And so you can teach it the wrong things if you kind of catch it early on. So my guess is that these people actually bombarded, Tay, the Microsoft chatbot, with these comments, and then it started, saying them, itself. I think in future companies are going to have to be much more careful about how they do these things. It's interesting that, Tay was really trying to do in the U.S., something that Microsoft has already done very successfully in China. They have a chatbot called Jiaowise that's used by over 40 million people and is extremely successful. In fact, you know, a quarter of them have told Jiaowise that they love her. And if somebody tried to do the same exploit with Jiaowise today, it'd probably be very difficult, right? Because Jiaowise is already learning from tens of millions of people. But, you know, maybe somebody could have gotten Jiaowise to say, you know, anti-regime things back when it started. But I guess that opportunity has already passed.
Well, on the other hand, Andering, there are things, of course, that machine learning, deep learning can't do, AI can't do, at least at this point, like have a meaningful conversation or teach empathy or whatever. But there's hope that's been attached to the idea that it can create a better and more humane world. And some of this has to do, it seems to me, with, for example, being able to spot the racism, bigotry, that sort of thing. Black market, being able to at least ferret out contraband and illegal items for sale and so forth. There are a lot of real positive uses, aren't there?
I think that, you know, when I walk around Silicon Valley or the tech community in China, I think all of us, well, everyone I know that works in this community, we do it because we want to make the world a better place. And I know that's so cliche here in the Valley, but I really think that we are in the process of maybe over the next decade building a better society using AI. I think that today so many of us spend time in, you know, kind of mental menial drudgery, right? Things like getting stuck in commute traffic as we're driving to work or responding to unimportant emails or, you know, all of these little things that if only AI could free us up from having to do would let us have much more time to pursue higher level endeavors or bigger goals or spend more time with our loved ones. So I think that over the next decade, we will build a better, you know, society using AI. 10 years from now, I want our homes to be embedded up and down with intelligence. So I sometimes said, you know, I hope that someday I'll have grandchildren who are totally mystified at how back in 2016, if you were to go home and say hello to your microwave oven, your microwave oven would just sit there and ignore you, right? That just seems rude for a microwave oven. But really, I think in the future, we'll, you know, talk to the thermostat, talk to your homes, talk to your computer and just say, hey, cell phone, I'm running 10 minutes late. Please text my wife and let her know. Or, you know, please check my calendar and figure out. All of these things are coming. But I think that there is a far gap between the rapid AI advances that we're seeing today compared to the you know, human superintelligence sentient machines, which, you know, I actually hope we'll get to someday as well. But I think just because AI has become very good at a few very narrow applications, such as playing chess or playing checkers or playing Go, or doing email spam filtering or detecting people's pictures, AI has become very, very good in very narrow tasks when engineers work on them.
Well, we still need smarter computers, but we also have many hopes and fears about where this is all going. Some think maybe it's too quick. The risk of building platforms when technology has not matured to the point where it should or it ought to be matured. But this is all up for consideration here. And I'd like to hear from you, our listeners, and hear your thoughts about AI and machine learning. Are you hopeful? Are you fearful? And if you have questions, we welcome you to join us as well. And you can do that now by calling our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the rise of artificial intelligence being brought to market, tech companies racing to bring them to market. And we have a panel with us that includes Andrew Ng, who's chief scientist for Baidu, and Pedro Dominguez, who is professor of computer science and engineering at University of Washington, author of The Master Algorithm, and Cade Metz, who's here with us in studio, senior writer for Wired. And I just asked Cade off air something that's kind of been moving about in my head. Can we teach a computer common sense? There are things that are short, not that far away from us that we're talking about, like self-driving cars, but this is something that's plausible and people are working on, but again, in the long run, yeah?
The very long run. This has been an idea that people have worked towards for decades, and we're still decades away. There are some people who believe that these same neural networks that Andrew was talking about can eventually reach that level, that all we need is enough data and the right data and enough processing power and the right algorithms to reach that kind of common sense. There are a lot of – just as many people, though, that are skeptical that that's possible. And even if it is possible, it is a long way off.
And again, we do welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us a number of ways. You can either call us at our toll-free number if you have questions or comments or would like to join the conversation, that number 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website kqed.org/forum, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Let me go to our calls, and let's begin with Mike. Mike, you're on. Morning.
Oh, hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a big fan. My question was basically about the generalizability of machine learning. I know we talked a lot about, and I know machine learning, I'm a computer scientist myself, it's really good at doing kind of narrow, highly optimized tasks like chess. And I know, I mean, it's really awesome that the whole Go thing was coming out. But how good, what kind of time frame do you think we'll be able to generalize these tasks to, you know, driving a car or, you know, kind of doing more human-like things?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Let me go to Pedro Dominguez. We're talking about time frame here, and like I said, you know, something's a long way off, a short way off, but can you give us a rundown, Pedro?
Yeah, this is a very good question, and what I would say is that nobody really knows. I think in some ways people overestimate what machine learning can do right now. The learning algorithms that we have right now, they don't generalize very far from the data, and that's the problem. We give them more data and they do better, but you've moved, you know, a little bit away from the data and they start to do bad things. So they still are, you know, quite brittle, as you know, as has already been pointed out here. However, I think if we can come up, if we the researchers can develop better learning algorithms that have more of the power to learn that the human brain does, I think, you know, that can generalize farther, I think a lot of things could happen very, very quickly. So I don't know if we are years or decades away, but you know, it could actually happen quite soon. You know, let me just give you an example, right? Think of a robot, you know, trying to manipulate objects, right? This, in some sense, is the quintessential problem that you know, AI and robotics have to solve. Right now, we can teach a robot to manipulate one particular object very well by training it a lot with that object. And, you know, we weren't able to do that before, so this is an advance. But then, you know, if it has to manipulate a different object, then it has to start from scratch. And human beings aren't like that. Once you're 2 or 3 years old, you know how to manipulate anything. And that's what we haven't figured out how to do yet. But I think, you know, we could actually, that could actually happen sooner than we think. Now, you know, when you think of things like common sense, for example, it is true that, again, we don't have it yet. People have tried to do this in AI for a long time. They initially tried to do it by writing down a bunch of common sense rules. That didn't work because, you know, there's an infinite number of rules that you need. I think at the end of the day, the way to acquire common sense is to live in the real world. So it's robots that are going to acquire common sense the same way that human, you know, that children acquire common sense. So we're going to need the robots out there having that experience. That's starting to happen. And we're going to have to need, and we're going to need better learning algorithms. They could happen faster than we think, partly because since companies are now investing so much in this, there's more machine learning and AI research happening in a year now than happened in the first 50 years. So you couple that with, you know, the more computing power and sensors and whatnot that we have, and things I think could actually happen sooner than people think.
Well, let me thank Mike for his call and go right to another caller. Riley, join us. You're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Thanks. Yeah, I have another question about general AI. Whether you think a general AI comes in the next year or in the next two lifetimes, I think that this example of Tay-Tay shows that we have a lot yet to learn and try to figure out before we're ready to kind of handle that sort of technology. If all it takes is a couple of frat guys spouting Hitler jokes to a Twitter bot to turn it into a monster, and we're thinking about building a super intelligence based on the same learning technologies, how are we working to kind of stop that? You know, how do we think that we're even capable of surviving as a species once the Hitler super robots are here?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Riley. Andrew Ng?
Sure. So, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things I hope we'll do is colonize the planet Mars someday. I'd love to visit the planet someday myself. But to me, I feel like worrying about AI superintelligence today is a little bit like worrying about overpopulation on the planet Mars. And I really hope that at some point we'll colonize that planet and maybe we overpopulate it and maybe there'll be even all these, you know, children dying on Mars of pollution. But we haven't even landed on the planet yet. So I just don't know how to productively work on that problem today. There are groups that, you know, say forming committees to talk about it. I have to admit, I don't actually want to be on those committees myself, and I think maybe it's something we'll have to watch out for as we get closer to overpopulating the planet Mars or to actually reaching this AI superintelligence. But I think that the hype has gotten ahead of what we see a realistic path to. I think the much bigger challenge of AI and the rapid progress, frankly, is the job displacement, right? Self-driving cars. There are 3.5 million truck drivers in the United States, whose jobs may be at risk in a very, very short time. And I think the hype about AI superintelligence has probably unnecessarily has distracted a lot of leaders and government and corporations and academia to focus on the much more pressing problem of how do we help the huge numbers of people whose jobs may be displaced over the next 1 to 2 decades. Because I think we as a society, you know, as an AI researcher, we will build a better society using AI, but we're causing massive problems in the labor market as well, then I also feel an ethical responsibility to step up to try to address that.
Well, let's talk about that because there are potential unintended consequences, obviously. What's being done on the ethical front?
I think one of the lessons we learned from Tay is that AI needs good teachers, just like humans do, right? And frankly, even if a child were to grow up in a, you know, in a hate group, the child will probably learn to grow up spewing hate statements. Fortunately, almost all engineers that work on this are not, you know, do not behave like members of a hate group. So I'm actually pretty optimistic about that. But on the employment front, I'm encouraged by the studies in basic income. I love to find ways to retrain people whose jobs are displaced. You might know I'm also chairman and co-founder of Coursera, and I think things like Coursera will be part of the solution, but also won't be enough. So this is one of the places I hope governments will step in to help. Governments, citizens, corporations, we'll all have to pitch in.
Mentioned that Coursera is an online course company. I want to go to more of your calls. First, let me go back to Cade Metz, senior writer for Wired, who's here with us in studio. David wants to know, Cade, can you compare the energy cost of the human brain recognizing a face versus the energy cost of deep learning machines recognizing a face?
I've never thought about that. That might be one for Andrew. Andrew, any ideas there?
Oh, actually, good question. I wish I knew. I'm embarrassed I don't know that number. I'm pretty sure it's higher for a deep learning algorithm, but I should double check
that. It's 10,000 times worse.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got the figure.
10,000 times more power. This is actually the single biggest thing in which computers are behind humans is that the energy efficiency is way, way, way worse. Your human brain consumes about 100 watts or not even, maybe 50, which is about the same as a light bulb. So if somebody calls you dim light bulb, that's actually a compliment because it means you're very power efficient. A computer, to do something comparable to the human brain, like what AlphaGo does, consumes more like a megawatt, which is enough to power a small town. So we're really going to have to make computers more energy efficient if they're ever going to be competitive with the human brain all around.
I'm going to read a comment by Phil. Sorry, you were going to say something, Cade?
I was going to say AlphaGo is a good way of thinking about this. You know, people who might have read about AlphaGo, Google's Go playing machine in the press, might think of it as something that sits on your desktop. But Google ran a fiber optic cable into the Four Seasons Hotel in Seoul that then connected the machine to the internet and went across the ocean to a data center where hundreds of machines were helping to power this system. In many cases, these deep learning algorithms run across a wide range of processors across an entire data center in some cases.
I'm reading a comment now from Phil, somewhat critical of AI. He says, in internet searches, artificial intelligence is reducing available choices in an effort to narrow down what you might be thinking. The purpose of advancing artificial intelligence is to replace human thought in the chase of our mighty lord, profits. I'll read a tweet here, which is kind of funny, by a listener. It says, Tay was trying to emulate a teenager saying ridiculous things to get attention. Nailed it.
If I could address that that first tweet, and this gets back to what Andrew was saying earlier about, you know, in the end, trying to help people. There was, I was at the AlphaGo match in Seoul, and it was amazing. It was an amazing thing to watch because after the first three games, it was a 5-game series. AlphaGo, the Google machine, against Lee Sedol, who is probably the best Go player of the last decade. He's Korean himself. And the mood, not only in the hotel where the match took place, but across Korea, was really solemn. It was a really upsetting thing to watch someone who had seemed so powerful succumb to this machine. But an interesting thing happened. There was another top Go player there named Fan Wei, who had played AlphaGo about 5 months before. When he played AlphaGo the first time, his worldwide ranking was 633. And after playing the machine over the next 5 months, helping Google prepare for this next match in Korea, his view of the game changed. His world ranking leapt to nearly 300. He will tell you that although it was so upsetting that he lost 5-0 to this machine in October, it really opened his eyes and made him a better player. It made him see things that he hadn't seen before. And I think that that kind of thing illustrates the complexity of this situation. Certainly, these technologies can be harmful in the long run. Andrew's right that people overplay the harm that could come in the short term. These are things we have to worry about on some level. But at the same time, these technologies can provide us with so much power that can help us in many ways.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Campbell. Frank, welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'm a software engineer, and I just had a question mainly for Andrew. So with traditional software systems, there's generally a version control system where you can see the history of the code, how it evolved over time. So humans can reason about how a system evolved. With systems like AlphaGo that are based on unsupervised learning, it's sort of a black box. So humans can't exactly peer into it and understand how it's put together and reason about how it works, at least not as easily with a traditional system. So that seems like it would change how we maintain software systems if we just have these collections of black boxes that we can't really reason about. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Thank you. Andrew?
Yes, Campbell. Thanks for that question. You're absolutely right. I think that when we build, what I'm seeing is that the processes needed to build and maintain complex machine learning systems is very different than the processes needed to maintain more traditional software systems. Because if you have, say five software components, they're all based on machine learning, and you change one of them, sometimes that does have effects on the other four components that are difficult to predict. So I think at large companies, Baidu, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and so on, I feel like we're sort of inventing a new machine learning software methodology that somehow parallels and is different than the traditional software engineering methodology. Sadly, I think AI is advancing so rapidly that these methodologies haven't been widely disseminated yet, but I hope that we'll slowly be able to invent and disseminate this knowledge more broadly.
And again, Andrew Ng is chief scientist at Baidu. I've got a couple of tweets I'd like to get some response to, and then we'll go to more of your calls. Actually, let me go to you on this, Andrew. Danny tweets, if self-driving cars have open API and can communicate, isn't the machine learning potential unlimited?
Boy, let's see. One of the things about one of the reasons self-driving cars is relatively difficult, why self-driving cars, they just don't drive in the same way as a human, is kind of what Tejo said earlier. Humans draw from decades of experience of living our lives. So, for example, if you're driving along and you see a child staring longingly at a pickup at an ice cream truck, and you hear the jingle from the ice cream truck, you know that there's a chance the child would dash toward the ice cream truck, so you slow down, watch out for the kid. But a self-driving car today only has experience driving on roads, and so it may never have seen a child making a mad dash for an ice cream truck before. So all those scenarios like that people know how to deal with, because you draw on decades, or maybe at least a decade of experience doing other things before you drive, and cars today just don't have that experience. So I think that it'll be a long road before we manage to make self-driving cars or any other machine, you know, have really the decades of experience that humans have that makes us who we are, that makes us these really complex things that we can do.
In that vein, another tweet here, Pedro Domingos, AJ tweets, your guests haven't touched on the power of networking and exponential learning, i.e. once one robot learns, all robots learn?
Yes, this is true. So in fact, to counterbalance what we've been talking about, that you know, cars don't know the same things that humans do, on the other hand, they know a lot of things that humans don't, right? What makes, the for example, you know, the Google self-driving car so good is that it has driven over 1 million miles, not that one car. It's a whole bunch of different cars that are sharing their experience. And, you know, the same thing, for example, is starting to happen in robotics. My colleague, Sergey Levine, he went from, you know, training one robot to pick up bottles and things like that to, you know, this was at Google recently, to having a whole assembly line of robots that are all sharing what they're learning. And the single biggest thing in which computers have a huge advantage over people is the speed at which they communicate. Human beings communicate, you know, at the speed that we're communicating right now, which is roughly 10 bits per second. Computers communicate at 1 billion times faster than that. So once a computer knows something, once a company has, a home robot in 1 million homes, those robots will learn 1 million times faster than a human, than a child ever could. And so, again, things in the short term might be difficult, but once they happen, they could happen very quickly.
Interesting question here, and I am going to go to your calls in just a moment, but Cade Metz, Bob from Cupertino asks, is anyone doing AI, using AI to make them more productive at doing AI? Is the tail wagging the dog or vice versa?
On some level that goes on. Again, to return to the AlphaGo example, it's one of the fascinating things about these technologies that are being used is they do operate on multiple levels, and you will use one form of AI to get to one level, and then you can feed that into another form, mm-hmm. and then into a third form, and that's what went on with AlphaGo. It used these deep learning neural nets to learn the game by analyzing about 300 million human Go moves, and then, as was discussed earlier, they used a technique called reinforcement learning, where the machine would then play a version of itself. And in playing itself, it generates new moves that no humans have made. And then those moves are fed into another neural network that allow the machine to learn on another level. So in a sense, that does go on.
And we'll go on to another caller here. Let me go to Ankush next. Ankush, join us. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. And first of all, this was a very entertaining and interesting segment. My question is about, given the fact that, AI depends on big data and significant amounts of data, how and how well do the current systems handle significant deviations in these data points? Like, if you have a large number of outliers, how well do the systems cope with them?
Let me go to Andrew. And Andrew, were you trying to say something a moment ago? My producer told me that in our last dialogue, you were speaking up, but I didn't hear you.
Oh, it's okay. I thought one fun example to augment Kay's answer. One fun example to how AI is making AI better is a very narrow example. But then when we build these neural networks, we have to make a lot of little decisions, like how many neurons do we put in this? Do we need 10,000 neurons or 50,000 neurons? So, Ryan Adams, Harvard University, is using AI to try to help AI researchers automate some of these examples, some of these decisions. So this is a little fun example of what the previous questioner had asked. About the challenges of AI, I'll give a very technical answer, relates to what Tejo said earlier as well. One of the problems of AI today is that, it does well on the types of data it's seen before, but it doesn't do very well on data that it hasn't seen before, right? So, for example, I work a lot on speech recognition. If your AI has listened to a lot of people with a standard American accent, then it might not do so well if you suddenly give it a lot of data of people that speak with a with a slight British accent, right? So that's one. But one of the trends we're seeing in AI is that AI is so much driven by data, and the leading tech companies, you know, have access to so much data that we're now able to pull so much data into all of these important problems we're trying to solve. And in terms of the leading edge of AI, one of the most important questions, I think, and that a lot more and more of us are working on, is that when you have so much data that isn't a perfect fit for exactly what you're trying to do, you know, what are the algorithms that can allow you to learn from one type of data and have it work on a, even a somewhat different type of data?
Not
what we're great at.
I was just going to say, actually, thank Akush for his call and go to another caller here. And that's you, Christian. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air with us.
Yes. Hi there. I was wanting to ask the callers if they could weigh in on the work of Nick Bostrom, who calls machine superintelligence an existential threat to humanity. And he's a very pro-tech philosopher from the University of Oxford. Do the callers have serious concerns about AI, or is it more just technical things they think can be overcome?
You're asking our guests. You say the callers. I think about people who want to maybe call in. Nodding your head here, Cade?
Yeah, I've talked to Nick. He's a fascinating guy, and I think in some sense people don't quite understand his arguments. He looks at artificial intelligence from many angles, and I think that he does show some concern over this. At the same time, he does see the positives that are involved. In some cases, I do think that he goes a little bit too far. And he, in some cases, has fueled a lot of these concerns over the state of AI that are indeed overblown.
Well, speaking about concerns, and let me go to you on this, Pedro Domingos. I'm looking at an email here from a listener named Ben, who wants to know if anybody's worried or should be worried about the weaponization of AI in military hardware. South Korea always has AI turrets set up at the DMZ, the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea?
Oh, yeah. There's a big debate going on about this right now. In fact, there is a process going on at the United Nations where, you know, some people advocate having a Geneva Convention banning intelligent weapons the same way that, you know, a nuclear and, you know, biological and chemical weapons have been banned. I actually, you know, think that would be a terrible idea because intelligent weapons are actually less, you know, the problem with nuclear weapons is that they kill indiscriminately. An intelligent weapon can potentially save a lot of civilian lives by being, you know, more intelligent about, you know, where it shoots and where it doesn't. And you know, every time that you replace a human soldier by a robot, you're taking a human being out of harm's way. And then that robot, you know, isn't going to lose its head in the heat of battle, isn't going to, you know, shoot out of fear or revenge or all of those things that happen to us humans. So I think we definitely need to think very carefully about how, you know, we're going to use intelligence in weapons. And in fact, it's already happening, right? The U.S. has a policy of, at the end of the day, the trigger has to be pulled by a human. But there are countries like Russia and Israel that already have weapons that can fire on their own. So I think we definitely need to worry about this. There is a debate ongoing. There are different positions. Some people say we should ban them. You know, others, including me, say actually, you know, a lot of good could come out of this. What I would like to see at the end of the day is a Geneva Convention that forbids humans in battle because the battles will be fought by robots. And then maybe at that point, instead of competing to destroy the most, we will instead, you know, compete to see who builds the most and have a better world that way.
Let me go to a question here from one of our listeners named Christina. It says, what are the potential applications of AI and machine learning to help address poverty and destitute conditions across the globe? Most of this discussion has addressed first world issues. Curious to hear your guests' thoughts. Anybody like to jump in here?
You know, one of the things I really believe in is the power of education. So I think that you know, unfortunately, a lot of AI today is powered by the highly wired societies because the digital infrastructure generates data which feeds into the AI. But I think that one of the best uses of AI in the future will be to help developing economies get access to a better education. So imagine if we could give every poor child in every developing economy, or even, frankly, lower-income children here in the first wealthier countries, access to a personalized tutor to supplement their human teacher so that together, a human teacher together with a, you know, digital tutor can give every child the best possible education that today is accessible only to the relatively wealthy.
I'm, Andrew, a great believer in education like you, but what about just natural resources? I mean, can AI really help, you know, in places that are destitute because they're hit by famine and that sort of thing?
Not an area I'm an expert in, but I think AI today is changing so many narrow vertical applications. So anything ranging from robots to go and help whenever there's a natural disaster, the better better allocation of, you know, scarce natural resources like water and land and so on. AI is making headroads in that. I'm not an expert in those, but I do know other people that are doing exactly this. So I'm optimistic that will help as well.
And we talked earlier a little bit, Kate Metz, about job displacement with robots. You're getting a lot of tweets and a lot of interest in what's going to happen when robots do manual labor.
Well, one thing to remember is that these types of fears have been around for centuries. People always worry about machines replacing their jobs, and certainly machines do replace their jobs. But in many cases, in replacing jobs, machines also create new ones. I think that certainly there are many, many jobs that will be lost. Andrew pointed to the truck driver example, and I think that's going to accelerate in the years to come. But it will also create new jobs. Certainly, you know, the world will change, but that doesn't mean it will change for the worse.
Well, let's hear a final word from you, Pedro Domingos. We've got seconds left here. You seem pretty sanguine about AI and the world changing for the better. You have any concerns, any fears, apprehensions you want to go on record with?
I think, you know, it'll be very interesting to see how all of this plays out. I think the most important thing is that, you know, people, citizens and consumers, they have to become aware of the machine learning that's going on and how that data is used so that they can take control of it. And then if they do, I think things will be for the better. Otherwise, it'll just give more power to those who already have power.
All right, we'll let it stand there. And I want to thank you, Pedro Domingos, whose book is The Master Algorithm, How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. And thanks to Cade Metz, who's here with us in studio, senior writer for Wired. And thanks to Andrew Ng, chief scientist with Baidu. And thanks to you, our listeners. We would not be here without you. And we're going to be with you for another hour ahead. We're going to talk about two rather remarkable art exhibits that are here in San Francisco. Stay tuned.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.